From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. President Donald Trump on Friday tweeted that he would be instructing the Treasury Department to examine the tax-exempt status of universities, saying, quote, too many universities and school systems are about radical left indoctrination, not education. The news came on the same day that the Catholic Church was revealed to have successfully lobbied for $1.3 billion in COVID-related relief funding from the government. The move is just the latest in attacks facing institutions of higher education in the U.S. Just as K-12 schools are facing massive budget shortfalls, colleges and universities are threatening to lay off faculty, reduce salaries of already underpaid adjunct instructors, and more. After that is the recent announcement by Immigration and Customs Enforcement that international students may be deported to their home countries or not even let into the U.S. if they're incoming freshmen, if their universities switch to online-only courses during the pandemic. We turn now to Mara Einstein, professor of media studies at Queens College at the City University of New York. She's also an independent marketing consultant. She's been working in or writing about media and marketing for more than 25 years and has written a number of books, including one that we had her on about Black Ops Advertising, Native Ads, Content Marketing, and the Covert World of the Digital Cell. Welcome back to the program, Mara.
Thank you so much, Sonali. Happy to be here.
So let's talk about what you are seeing happening at City University of New York. You are at Queens College, and it seems as though what's happening there might be typical of what's happening at institutions of higher education nationwide.
Yeah, there's a lot of things going on. The way I like to describe what's happening is it's sort of like when you go to the beach and you get caught into an undertow. It's just when you think you're about to get up and be able to grab your breath, another wave comes over and hits you. And that's what it sort of feels like to be in higher education right now. In the spring, like all schools had to jump out of the classroom and start teaching in the online format. It wasn't an easy transition. And the problem for us, which was different from some of the private institutions, was that our students then had to work from home. We went online and then found out a lot of our students didn't have the technology at home in order to be able to access the online format, or they didn't have a quiet space at home, or they didn't have the internet access. And so then we had to stop. And then we had to start again. So right now, what we're dealing with is because of COVID and because of people not working and increased unemployment, we've also have much reduced taxes, which means we have a lot less money coming to the institution. What's also happened, and because of that, we're in the situation of having to lay professors off or, you know, just not reappoint them, which is what you were discussing. But part of the problem is that we were given money by the federal government, but we weren't given permission about or instructions about how to use that money. So there's a pot of money that's sitting there that could be used to help save some of these jobs, but it hasn't been released, or the institutions aren't being particularly transparent about how that money is being used. So, before we knew what the budget was going to be, we had been asked to cut our budgets, to let some of the faculty go. And that was before we even knew what was going on in terms of what the budgets were going to be. But I think one of the key points that I really want to stress in all of this is that we were already severely defunded before we even got to the situation that we are in now. We're not at the bone. We're getting into core organs in terms of how much we're having to cut right now. And so it's so bad. We are at the point where if we have to let any more faculty go, we will not be able to offer the classes that our students need in order to be able to graduate in 4 years.
Now, your college in particular and a lot of institutions of higher education that are state run and state funded serve primarily students of color and students from low income communities. So defunding these institutions directly impacts the progress of racial justice, right?
Yes, and that's one of the things that a core point that we've been trying to make is that at Queens College, 73% of our student population are students of color. And so we have also been able to prove our institution, as opposed to some of the more elite institutions, we can demonstrate that we bring people fully into the middle class in a way that other institutions don't. And What we know is that while, and I'll talk about this as a marketer, while we know the elite institutions do a very good job about talking about being diverse, they aren't really diverse. Most of people of color, particularly African Americans that are at these institutions, many of them are not from here. They are Black students who come from outside of the United States. There also is no diversity in terms of socioeconomics. And so for those institutions, that is a marketing element. And while we are on the ground teaching, teaching first generation students and teaching students that come from a very diverse background, and helping, we are educating the essential workers, right? Mm. Those essential workers who put their bodies and their lives on the line while the rest of us stayed home or could stay home and work. Those are the same people that we're educating. The nurses and the social workers and all of those other folks are coming to our schools, or they're working in those essential worker jobs while they're going to school.
Mara, there was also, of course, an underlying issue of how poorly paid faculty had been. Little by little, there was a time when being a faculty member at a university was a job that sort of guaranteed some economic security. And then with the advent of adjunct faculty in particular, who get paid below poverty level wages, you started seeing those wages drop and drop and drop. I mean, I understand that there are, and I'm not in academia, but I have friends who are, some of whom complain about being offered $1,200 to teach a couple of times a week course over 3 months. I mean, that may not even cover their rent for that month.
Right. Well, we were in the particularly awkward situation of our faculty, our adjunct faculty had finally gotten a raise to a point where their classes, the amount of money they were being paid for their classes wasn't great, but it was substantially better than it was before. And so when we were at the point of having to cut our budget, the increased salary rate for those adjunct faculty actually ended up having a negative impact on how many classes we had to cancel. So it was sort of a double whammy in terms of that, in terms of trying to figure out what our budgets were going to be. But I think what a lot of people don't understand in terms of the economics of higher education is that when I started teaching 20 years ago, there was approximately 37% of faculty were tenured faculty. And before that, the numbers were closer to 50 and 60%. But now it's under 30%. It's more like it's 27 or 29% of faculty are full-time tenured or tenure track faculty. Everyone else is what's known as contingent faculty. Those are the adjunct professors. So those are people who may have been teaching. Most of them have PhDs. Most of them have been teaching as long as some of the tenured faculty have, but they aren't being hired as tenured faculty because it becomes a way for the institution to save money by paying less for labor. The other part of the problem is that in the 80s, there was a fundamental shift in the thinking in the United States about how to fund higher education. So under Reagan, the idea of an education went from being a public good, right? The idea of the more educated your populace was, the better it would be for your community, to being a personal good, or that's the way they talked about it. And so what happened was, instead of money being given to higher education in the form of grants, the money was given in the form of student loans. And so what begins to happen is that the cost of education moves from being on the government through your tax dollars to being on the backs of individuals.
And we know today there's a massive crisis in student loans that so many Americans are crippled by. So you gave a little bit of that history, but today, who bears the responsibility for the defunding of our state university systems? Are they, I mean, there's cities, there's states, and then there's the federal government.
It happens at all of those levels. And I would also note as well that there had been some increasing in the amount of money that was going into higher education. And then we had the recession of 2008. And there was a huge defunding of higher education. And those numbers were starting to come back up, but not anywhere near where they were prior to that. And what makes me so angry oftentimes is to hear politicians talk about education, you know, free education for all, or saying they're the education senator or governor or whatever it is. But the fact of the matter is a lot of the plans that they put into place to do that aren't actually serving the students. And I can give an example based on New York. So there's something called the Excelsior program, which was something that the governor made a big hoopla about, that certain students whose families made less than a certain amount of money could go to school for free. But the strings that were attached to going to school for free was that they had to be full-time students. Almost none of our students are full-time students. And if you look at the statistics over the country, most students are not full-time students. That's a very small group of students that go to campus, go for 4 years, you know, continue and so on. And so that program really served a very, very small number of students. And even the students who got into the program oftentimes had the problem of not being able to finish on time because we were so underfunded, we couldn't offer the classes that they needed in order to be able to graduate in that 4 years.
Wow. So we have this situation now where universities are being defunded, but we also have at the same time in the last few months a national conversation around, say, defunding the police. And we see in New York, where you are, NYPD is, you know, has a multi-billion dollar budget. There is a movement to try to strip some funding from the police department. There are people occupying, you know, in front of the city hall to demand that $1 billion be cut from the budget, and you see such resistance to cutting police budgets, but no such similar resistance to cutting the budgets of universities.
Part of this, Sonali, I think really comes down to that a lot of people that are writing about higher education went to those elite schools. And so they frame the social conversation around higher education in relationship to their own experience. And like I said, that four-year residential experience is a very, like, less than 25% of students, and I think it's even lower than that, have that sort of experience. Most students go to school part-time. Community colleges are a large part of the student population. The fact of the matter is, only 40%, this is an amazing statistic, only 40% of students who start college finish college.
Wow.
40%. That's it. So we're somewhere, this system needs a fundamental reboot in terms of, and some of that goes back to what you were talking about, which is the issue of debt, right? Some students have to leave because they can't afford to pay. They can't afford to stay in school. And there's all kinds of issues in terms of job security, in terms of food security. All of those things come into play when we're talking about higher education.
And all of that feeds into our growing income inequality. And then you have a president who clearly feeds off of perpetuating less and less education in our country, because, of course, the his entire presidency seems to be based on a lack of information, on misinformation, on miseducation, who's now threatening to revoke the tax-exempt status of universities, which would in turn threaten even more funding. Then you also have the attack that I mentioned earlier from ICE. This came out of nowhere as universities were talking about how to reopen in the fall or whether to reopen at all. Many were already announcing they would stick with online-only learning. You had ICE turn around and say, well, if you're a foreign student and you're going to a school that is online-only learning, you have to go back to your home country. Or if you got into a school, you can't even enter the nation. How does that impact Queen's College, where you are at? And in general, what do you think, you know, how do you view this attack on foreign students? There's about a million foreign students in the U.S. today who are, you know, stimulating the economy by paying out of pocket, most of them, because there's very few scholarships that they're eligible for. And I say that from experience as a former foreign student myself on an F-1 visa. They're now considering whether they have to leave.
Yeah, I mean, there's two parts to this question about foreign students. I've actually been working on a book about marketing higher education for several years now. And, every time something like this happens, I have to sort of reframe and figure out how I'm going to be talking about this. But one of the things that I was looking at as I was doing research for the book was talking to admissions directors. And so one of the things that has been happening over a long period of time is, and anyone who has a kid in college right now absolutely knows this, right? The cost of higher education has been going up and up and up and up and up and up and up. Part of the reason for that was just a demographic situation. It had to do with millennials. And so there was this huge pool of prospective students. And so colleges knew, you know, whatever they could charge, that they would probably be able to put the students into those seats in the fall. And so as the upper end of the spectrum started charging more money, a lot of the middle schools started charging more money. Well, if you're a Harvard, you can charge that extra money because people will be willing to pay for it. But if you're a smaller, you know, liberal arts college in the middle of the country that doesn't have that kind of name recognition, you've been increasing your tuition, but people won't necessarily be willing to pay for that. So what they were having to do more and more was to tap into international students to help make up for the extra money that they were charging. And so, because foreign students tend to pay full freight, and certainly for public institutions like ours, and this is true of any public institution in the country, if you're outside of the area, you pay more money than the people who live in the area to go to that institution. So for them, if they become more and more dependent on international students to make up for the money that they're losing or that they're charging or to help subsidize the American students, then if they start to lose those students, those colleges are in a lot of trouble. They were in a lot of trouble before this happened. They were looking at bankruptcy before this happened. So now that we've had this issue in terms of the international students having to go in person, that becomes an added problem. For us at CUNY, this affects thousands of students, obviously, across all of our campuses. And what happened was that the way that is talked about is that students have to, or I think they're allowed to take one class online, but the rest of the classes have to be in person. And that was waived in the spring and it was waived in the summer. But the government is saying they will no longer waive that in the fall. And they're saying that students have to be there in person. Now, what that means and how much of a class has to be in person, we don't know. But we will do everything we can, whether it's creating independent studies, whether it's making sure that our classes are at least hybrid in some way, so that these students can stay. We will find a way for those students to stay.
And Harvard and MIT, I understand, have filed a lawsuit already against the federal government, against ICE, and there's going to be a hearing set for next Tuesday, a pretty high stakes hearing, and the judge indicated that their case does look pretty good. So we'll certainly see what happens with that. So specifically to your Queens College in New York, where you are a city university, part of the City University of New York system, serving primarily students of color, I understand that you have a petition in place to stop the defunding. I imagine that there might be other petitions by other universities and colleges, state-run especially, around the country to try to preserve these institutions. What do you hope will happen in the next few months? Because while this defunding has a long history, this is not something new. It goes back to Reagan, as you were saying. We're now in this brand new, bizarre and frightening scenario with this pandemic that is already, that is making an already challenging situation even more challenging. I mean, we started our conversation with you talking about the difficulties with online learning, but that seems to unfortunately be the only safe way to continue in the fall.
Right. Well, look, there's a difference between how classes were taught in the spring and how classes are going to be taught in the fall. Because what happened in the spring was that we were teaching in-person classes and we suddenly had to turn them into online classes. And it's very different to create a class as an online class than it is to try and change something that was created in another format to suddenly appear online. And so the experience in the fall will certainly be better for students than it was in the spring. I'm hoping it's better for faculty too, for that matter. In terms of students coming back, we actually have a waiting list for freshman students at our campus at Queens. And I think that's true for a number of reasons. I think that there are probably families who unfortunately lost their jobs and can't afford to send their students to campuses they might have sent them to otherwise. It might be the situation that the parents said, I don't want you halfway across the country while all of this is going on. I'd rather you stay home. Or they said, look, if everybody's going to be teaching classes online, I'm not going to spend $50,000 or $60,000 for you to go across the country and then sit in a dorm room and take a class. You'll stay home and take the class here. So in terms of freshman enrollments, we're actually have a waiting list, like I said. Returning students is another thing. I think I'm starting to see that they're slowly starting to enroll and those classes are enrolling. But there's a lot of trauma here. And a lot of trauma for the faculty, a lot of trauma for the students. And I think the long-term mental health issues related to this is something that we haven't even begun to wrap our brains around.
Well, Mara, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. I suspect this might be the first of some more conversations around this issue as it unfolds. I appreciate all the work you do. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. My guest has been Mara Einstein, Professor of Media Studies at Queens College at the City University of New York. She's also an independent marketing consultant. She's been working in or writing about media and marketing for more than 25 years and is the author of a number of books, including Black Ops Advertising, Native Ads, Content Marketing, The Covert World of the Digital Cell. We've been discussing the attacks on higher education. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Are You with Sonali?